kicking so light and careful that I didn't feel any pain at all and was surprised when he was done. Afterward, he asked if I wanted an orange soda and a chicken salad sandwich. I had them both, sitting on the bumper of the trailer with the daylight shining in my face. The sandwich was on sun-warmed slices of seeded rye, and the soda was in a can, sweating drops of ice water, and for a while I felt almost human. A convict, the sort of fat man who was described as morbidly obese, sat on the trailer with the dead folks. He had his right boot off and the foot mummied up in bandages. I caught his name, Teasdale, but didn't learn much more about him, not then. We didn't talk until later. Just as I drained the last fizzy-sweet mouthful of soda, a voice, flat and staticky, burst from the walkie-talkie on Dillett's hip. It was Yul Brynner. Dillett, you there? Over. Copy. I got three males here in shiny silver dresses, claiming they were ambushed by the lady with you and her deranged boyfriend, Mr. X. I'm placing them all under arrest. If we can't make the kidnapping charge stick, we can still get them for crimes against fashion. Pack it up and haul that flatbed down to Denver. I want to remind you to get off at Uptown Avenue and take the cargo to the ICE Center. If there's photos of what you're carrying on CNN tonight, you'll be lucky to wind up working as a crossing guard. That order is straight from the governor. You hear? Over. Copy that, Dillett said. I noticed neither of them ever used the word corpse on the radio. Dillett and Teasdale spent a few minutes arranging a crinkly orange tarp over their harvest of the dead and strapping the bodies down with bungee cords. Then all of us climbed up into the cab of Dillett's John Deere, the corpulent prisoner sitting in the middle. Dillett handcuffed one of Teasdale's wrists to a steel bar under the dash. Dillett's John Deere was the size of a shed on wheels, and when I was up in the cab, I was a full 9 feet off the road. This was no little family tractor. When he got it going, the engine roar was so loud, I thought it might shake the teeth out of my gums. "What did you do?" I asked Teasdale. "I cut my landlord's head off with a hacksaw," he said in a cheery voice. "It was self-defense, but you can't find a jury anywhere that isn't biased against people who struggle with their weight." "No," I said. "I meant what happened to your foot." "Oh, I stepped on an 8-inch nail, went right through the sole of my boot into my heel. Blame my extreme size. When there's been unhappiness in my life, my obesity has usually been the cause." "Ouch, 8 inches? Are you messing with me?" "No," Dillett answered for him. "I took it out myself. It was about the size of a walrus tooth. I didn't know the nails could get that big." "She ain't heard about Enid," Teasdale said. Dillett looked glum and nodded somberly. "What about Enid?" I asked. "Enid, Oklahoma?" Dillett said, "It's gone. It poured spikes as big as carrots there, killed people in their houses. Storm only lasted 20 minutes, and they're saying over half the city's population was wiped out. The storms are tearing their way east and getting worse as they go. The sparkle dust, the stuff that grows into crystals, is following the westerlies right across the nation." "We can't say we weren't warned," Teasdale told us in a contented tone. "When were we warned it might rain nails?" Dillett asked him. "Was that on the Weather Channel and I missed it?" "It's a global climate change," Teasdale said. "They've been talking about it for years. Al Gore, Bill Nye, we just didn't want to listen to them." Dillett couldn't have looked more stunned if Teasdale had opened his mouth and a dove flew out. "Climate change, my ass. This isn't climate change." "Well, I don't know what else you'd call it. It used to rain water. Now it's raining blades of silver and gold. That is a change of climate." Teasdale rubbed a thumb against his chin, then said, "Ghosts is next." "You think it's going to rain ghosts?" "I think we'll have ghosts instead of fog. The mist will wear the faces of the departed, all those we had and lost." "You better hope for clear weather then," Dillett said. "If a fog made out of ghosts rolls in, your landlord might turn up wanting his back rent." "I count my blessings to live in a dry mountain climate," Teasdale told me complacently. "I'll face whatever blows in on the wind. It may come to blow gales of pure sadness instead of air and leave us all taking shelter from grief. Maybe time itself will begin to crest and drop instead of temperature. We might have the 19th century for winter. For all we know, we might have already slipped into the future without noticing it." Dillett said, Dream on, Teasdale. There aren't going to be ghosts, and there aren't going to be downpours of emotion either. We are dealing with chemical warfare, plain and simple. The Arabs who were behind 9/11 are behind this. Our president knew it was a mistake to ever even let him in here, because this is what happens. The NSA only just established that the company that invented hard rain technology was financed with Arab money. They developed the science of it with American researchers, then brought the technology to their headquarters in old Persia. Congress is working on a declaration of war tonight. They think they unleashed a storm. They don't know the half of it. The president has already promised to go nuclear. There might be some more strained weather coming after all. I doubt they've had much snow in Iran, so a face full of atomic fallout should be quite the refreshing experience for them. By then we had reached a cloverleaf of on-ramps and off-ramps at the outskirts of Denver. Dillett steered us off the turnpike and onto US 287. Off the thruway, things were in bad shape. Cars had been shoved to the sides of the road, but the blacktop was covered in broken glass and shards of crystal. A tasty freeze was boiling a greasy cloud of black smoke, but no one was fighting the fire. We spent another 15 minutes thundering down to the ice center at the promenade, a big indoor rink surrounded by a few acres of asphalt. A dozen official-looking black cars were parked in the area around the loading docks, along with several ambulances, a jumble of police cruisers, a pair of big armored prisoner transport vehicles, and a fleet of hearses. Dillett pulled up to a stainless steel garage-type door. He turned the tractor and carefully reversed until the flatbed was right up against the closed roller door. "You're sticking the dead here?" I asked, feeling queasy. Years before, when my parents were still together, they'd taken me to see Disney on Ice here. "It's one place to keep 'em cold," Dillett said. He blatted his horn and someone opened a regular-sized door at the top of a loading dock. It was another state trooper, a freckled redhead, who looked like Archie from Riverdale. Dillett rolled down his window and yelled for him to open the garage door to the rink. The kid who looked like Archie shook his head and screamed something about a Zamboni, but it was hard to tell what he was yelling over the thresher roar of the tractor. They hollered back and forth like that, neither of them making any sense to the other, and finally Dillett opened the driver's side door and stepped onto the running board. No sooner had he straightened up than Teasdale stuck out his left foot, his bandaged bad foot, and kicked Dillett in the ass. Dillett waved his arms and looked foolish for a few seconds before spilling down to the blacktop. Teasdale pulled the driver's side door shut and slid in behind the steering wheel. He put the tractor into gear. His handcuffed right hand couldn't reach the steering wheel, but it was in the perfect place to handle the stick. The tractor began to rumble across the lot. "What do you think you're doing?" I asked him. "I am making a boat for freedom," he said. "They won't never come after me, what with all that's going on, and I have family in Canada." "Do you plan to drive there in this John Deere, hauling 80 dead bodies behind you?" "Well," he said mildly, "one thing at a time." Archie from Riverdale jumped up onto the running board. He had crossed the parking lot at a sprint to catch us before we got on the road. Teasdale opened the driver's side door, hard and fast, and clouted him off. We drove on, picking up speed. We were doing almost 30 when Teasdale swerved into the road, catching a piece of the curb. Bungee cables popped. Bodies sailed off the flatbed and into the air, rolled across the sidewalk like flung logs. "Were you going to let me out, or were you planning to take me on your mad dash to the Yukon?" "You can jump any time you like, but I'm afraid it wouldn't be convenient to slow down just yet. I'll wait. I don't suppose if we passed a hardware store you'd run in and grab me a hacksaw so I can cut myself loose of the cuffs? I'd drive you on to see this fella you're looking for, even though it'd be going out of my way." "Considering what you last used a hacksaw for, you'll have to find someone else to do your shopping." He nodded in an understanding way. "Fair enough. I appreciate I don't have a great track record with household tools. I forgot to mention that I also took a hammer to my landlord's wife. I didn't kill her, though. She's fine. I understand she recently recovered full use of her legs." I didn't recover full use of my legs for 15 minutes. He tore along without stopping, taking corners hard, throwing corpses off the trailer at every turn. I didn't bother to tell him he was leaving a trail any fool could follow. A man who steals a 10-ton John Deere isn't thinking about being inconspicuous. Finally, we reached an intersection blocked by a jackknife tractor trailer, and the only way around was to drive up over the curb and across a small green park in front of a credit union. To navigate this new terrain, it was necessary to slow almost to a crawl. Teasdale shot me a friendly look. "How's here?" he asked. "Better than Canada," I said, and opened the door. "Well, take care of yourself, and don't murder anyone else." "I'll try not to," he said. He peered speculatively into the rearview mirror at the line of stony peaks behind us. "Keep an eye on the skies. I do believe it's clouding up." He was right. A cold, icy-looking range of clouds stood above the mountains themselves. They weren't thunderheads, but rather a great mass of vapor that promised a long, steady drizzle. Teasdale chunked the tractor back into gear as soon as I was on the running board. I hopped down and watched him rumble away. Once he was out of sight, I fumbled for my cell phone to call the police and report on what Teasdale was planning. I had to check the pockets of my jeans twice before I remembered I didn't have a phone anymore. I didn't have a clue where I might find the nearest cop, but I did know which way it was to Dr. Rusted's house, and I set out once more. As I tramped into downtown, the wind rose behind me, funneled through the deep trenches between high-rises. It smelled like rain. As I entered central Denver, I was struck most by the hush. No traffic, no shops open. On Glenarm Place, I could hear a woman sobbing from an open third-floor window. The sound carried for blocks. The nails were scattered all over the streets, flashing silver and rose in the late afternoon light. The storm had lashed the high vertical sign in front of the Paramount, so it just read R-O-U-T. The other letters had come loose and dropped in the street. A girl wandered along wearing a wedding gown that didn't fit and a homemade tiara fashioned from gold wire and crystal nails. She had on elbow-length silk gloves and carried a heavy-looking burlap sack. Close up, it was possible to see that the gown was in tatters and her cheeks were dribbled with smeared mascara. She walked beside me for a while. She told me she was the queen of the apocalypse and said if I'd kiss her and swear my fealty to her, she'd pay me $10,000. She opened the sack to prove she had the money. It was packed full with bundles of cash. I told her I had to pass on the kiss. I informed her I was in love and didn't play around. I said she ought to use some of that money to get off the street and into a hotel room. Rain was going to fall. She said she wasn't afraid of bad weather. She said she could walk right between the raindrops. I said I couldn't, and at the next corner we went our separate ways. The whole town wasn't a post-rapture wasteland, and I don't want to give you the idea it was. The National Guard had cleared East Colfax for most of a mile and installed first aid stations and storefronts. They had established a thriving HQ and information center at the Fillmore. The marquee promised bottled water, first aid shelter, information. Generators roared noisily, and several places had lights on. The wrought iron fence outside was plastered over with photocopies showing people's faces above their names and the words, "Missing since storm, please contact." But the soldiers I saw looked flush and scared, barking at people to find shelter. A Humvee rolled up and down the avenue with PA loudspeakers on top, broadcasting information from the National Weather Service. A woman said an area of depression was building over the Boulder-Denver metro region, and rain was expected within the hour. She didn't say what kind of rain and didn't need to. I headed north to East 23rd Avenue and into City Park, the last stretch of my long hike. It was the quietest place I'd been yet, and the most mournful. I slowed as I neared the zoo. An 18-wheeler had been parked in the road, and there was an adult giraffe spilled across the open flatbed trailer, legs sticking off the side and long neck curled up so her head touched her breast. A guy in a hard hat motored a little crane over, crystal splinters snapping under its heavy tires. He pulled alongside the 18-wheeler. Hydraulics whined, and the crane operator lowered a net with a baby giraffe in it. He placed the calf daintily between its mother's legs. They were both stained with blood and filth. and the sight of them broke my heart like nothing else I'd seen all day. The air was rank, and on my left, in a broad green meadow, arranged neatly in pairs, were dead lions and dead walruses and dead gazelles. It was like some horrible parade leading toward a cruel parody of Noah's Ark, a ship for everything that was gone and never coming back, everything that would not be saved. There was a pile of penguins almost 10 feet high. They stank like week-old fish. I plodded the last dreary quarter mile under lowering skies in a strange, pearly twilight. My sewed-up skull was banging, and the steady throb of it nauseated me. The closer I got to Dr. Rusted's house, the less I wanted to get there. It was impossible, after all I'd seen, to imagine I would find anything good. It seemed childish to hope for any small mercy now. Dr. Rusted and his family had lived in a pretty brick Tudor east of the park, a place with tangles of ivy matting the walls between the mullioned windows. It looked like the sort of place where C.S. Lewis might meet J.R.R. Tolkien to share some scotch and discuss their favorite ancient Germanic poems. It even had a modest tower on one end. Yolanda slept in the round room at the top, and whenever I visited, I'd yell up, "Hey, Rapunzel, how they hangin'?" I slowed as I stepped into the front yard. Leaves shivered in the aspens to either side of the house. I could not say why the dark and the stillness of the place so troubled my mind. Most of the houses on the street were dark and still. Across the road, a small, tidy, compact man was sweeping nails out of his concrete driveway. He quit what he was doing, though, to stare at me. I had seen him around. A 50-something who sported square-framed glasses, a conservative haircut, and an air of chilly disapproval. He was packed into a shiny, violently green tracksuit that brought to mind Radioactivity, the Jolly Green Giant, and Gumby. I rapped twice on the door, and when there was no reply, turned the latch and stuck my head in. "Dr. Rusted? What's up, Doc? It's me, Honeysuckle Speck." I was going to call again, and then I saw a shadow I didn't like, near the bottom of the stairs, and let myself in. Dr. Rusted was on his face, halfway to the kitchen. He wore a gray vest, a white Oxford shirt, and charcoal slacks with a sharp crease in them. Black socks, no shoes. He lay with one cheek against the dark wooden floor. His face looked bare and bewildered without his gold spectacles. His hands were mittened in bandages, and the Oxford shirt was torn and spotted with blood, but he hadn't died from those wounds. It looked as though a head-first plunge down the stairs had killed him. His neck was swollen to the touch. I thought it might be broken. I had walked a long way to carry a message I hadn't wanted to deliver, and now it turned out there was no one to receive it. I was tired and headachy and sick at heart. After I came out to my parents, my father wrote me a letter saying he'd rather his daughter was raped to death than be a lesbian. My mother simply refused to acknowledge I was gay and would not look at or talk to any of my girlfriends. When she was in a room with Yolanda, she pretended she couldn't see her. But Dr. Rusted always liked to have me around, or if he didn't, he always made the effort to pretend. We drank beer and watched baseball together. Over dinner, we'd rag on the same right-wing politicians, getting each other riled up, competing to see who could insult them the most creatively without actually being obscene, until Yolanda and Mrs. Rusted pleaded with us to talk about anything else. Is it odd to say I liked the way he smelled? It always made me feel cozy and content to catch a whiff of his bay rum aftershave and the faint odor of the pipe he wasn't supposed to smoke. He smelled like civilization. Like decency. The phone was dead. No big shock there. I drifted from room to room, wandering the museum of the departed Rusted family. As I roamed, I was seized with the certainty that no one would ever live there again. No one would heave themselves down on that big striped couch to watch the latest UK imports, the Great British Baking Show and Midsummer Murders, the kind of programs Mrs. Rusted had liked best. No one would pick through the cans of tea in the kitchen cupboard, trying to decide between Lady Londonderry and Creme of Earl Grey. I climbed the tower stairs to Yolanda's room, my throat constricting with grief, even before I pushed open the door to look in there for the last time. Her round room was done in pinks and yellows like a hollowed-out birthday cake. She had left it in her usual state of manic disarray, a heap of unwashed clothes in one corner, a single sneaker in the center of her desk, half the drawers hanging out of her dresser, and a watch with a broken leather strap in the middle of the floor. Her jewelry was scattered across the top of her dresser instead of in the jewelry box, and tights had been hung over the foot of the bed to dry. I picked up a throw and pressed my face to it, inhaling the faint scent of her. When I left the room, I wore the blanket over my shoulders like a robe. It was August outside, but in Yolanda's room it felt like late fall. I descended the stairs and had a peek in the master bedroom. Dr. Rested's gold spectacles were still on the end table, and the counterpane bore the rumpled imprint of a big man's body. His tasseled shoes stuck out slightly from under the bed. A framed photo of all of us, Dr. Rested, Mrs. Rested, Yolanda, and myself, on a trip we made to Estes Park, was face up in the center of the bed. Maybe he'd had a sleepless night, worrying about his wife and daughter, and had dozed off with that picture of all of us together, cradled to his chest. He could have been hugging any of the thousand of photographs he owned of Yolanda and Mrs. Rested, but it made me almost feel like bawling that he'd picked one that included me. I never wanted to be liked by anyone so much as I wanted to be liked by Yolanda's parents. Understand, I wasn't just in love with her. I was in love with her family, too. It threw me at first how often they held each other and kissed and laughed and enjoyed one another and never seemed to find fault. I'd never cared a damn about crosswords until I learned that Dr. Rested liked them, and then I began doing them every day on my iPad. I helped Mrs. Rested make ginger cookies just because it made me feel good to be near her and hear her muttering to herself in her lyrical island accent. I left the throw blanket with the picture and made my way back outside. I stood just in front of the rainbow-colored banner extending from an angled flagpole bolted to one of the brick columns flanking the front steps. Gumby had retreated to the entrance of his garage, and a daughter had appeared. The daughter was maybe 14, willowy and bulimia thin, with sunken cheeks and circles under her eyes. She wore a tracksuit, too, black with purple piping, and the word juicy across her butt. I wondered what kind of father let his 14-year-old wear that. "You know there's a man dead over here?" I asked. "There's dead folks everywhere," he said. "This one was murdered," I said. The 14-year-old girl twitched, tugged nervously at a silver bangle around her wrist. "What do you mean he was murdered? Of course he was. Probably 10,000 people were murdered yesterday. Everyone who was caught outside, including a quarter of the people on this road." He spoke calmly, without distress or much apparent interest. "He wasn't killed by the rain. Someone surprised him and shoved him down the stairs, and he got his neck broken. You hear anything?" "Sure I have. People have been screaming and crying and carrying on all day. Jill and John Porter walked up the street this morning, each one of them carrying one of their shredded 10-year-old twins. The Porters were out looking for their girls all night. I prayed they'd find them. But maybe I should have prayed they didn't, considering the condition the children were in. The two little girls had hidden together under an overturned wheelbarrow, but it was too rusted out to stop the nails. Their mother Jill was sobbing and shouting that her babies were dead until John gave her the back of his hand and shut her up. After that, I decided I'd heard all the awfulness I wanted to hear, and I haven't paid attention to any shouting or screaming ever since." He took a lazy, disinterested look at the back of his wrist, then shifted his gaze to me once again. "It was a judgment, of course. I'm lucky my own daughter was spared. Everyone on this street let your girlfriend look after our children." I felt a clammy, cool feeling spread out from the nape of my neck down my spine. "You want to elaborate on that? What happened yesterday has happened before. To Sodom and Gomorrah," he informed me. "We let your sort mingle with our sort as if we didn't know there would be a price to be paid, as if we hadn't been warned. He claimed to be a man of God, that one. nodding to the house. He should have known.
Dad,
said the teenage girl in a quavering, frightened voice. She'd seen the look on my face. Keep talking, buddy, I said, and you won't have to worry about celestial retribution. You'll get some right here on Earth. He turned and took his daughter by the elbow and steered her away into the garage, past a gray Mercedes with a sticker saying that somewhere in Kenya a village was missing its idiot. He was walking his daughter up the step toward the door into the house when I called out to him again. Hey, sport, you got the time? He took another look at his naked wrist, then caught himself and shoved the hand into his pocket. He swatted his girl on the bum and urged her ahead of him into the house. Then he hesitated, glaring back at me, searching for one last insult to put me away. Nothing came to him. Quivering now, he took two last brisk steps up into his house and slammed the door behind him. I went back into the Rustin's house. The stillness could be felt almost like a shift in barometric pressure, as if the interior of the brick Tudor existed at a different altitude, had a unique climate of its own. Maybe Teasdale was right, and henceforth emotions would register as weather, as atmospheric change. The light was silver and gray, and so was the mood. The temperature hovered a little below lonesome. I curled up on the big king in the master bedroom, under Yolanda's throw, holding the photo of us all together in Estes Park. I would have cried if I could have, but as I've said before, I've never been what you would call a crying woman. When my mother wept, it was a manipulation. When my father cried, it was because he was drunk and feeling sorry for himself. I never felt anything except contempt when confronted with someone in tears, until the first time I saw Yolanda weeping, and it twisted my heart. Maybe if we'd had more time, she would have taught me to cry. Maybe if we'd had more time together, I would have learned how to wash my infected parts clean in a good, healthy flow of tears. As it was, I only curled up and dozed for a bit, and when I woke, it was raining again. It was a soft tick-tick against the roof, not like drops of water, but crisper, sharper, a kind of crackling. I left the bedroom and wandered to the open front door and peered out into it. The rain came down in a steady drizzle of shining needles, no bigger than what a tailor might use to pin up a sleeve. They bounced where they struck the flagstones and made a pretty tinkling. It was such a sweet sound that I stuck my hand out, palm up, as if to sample a warm summer shower. Youch! In an instant, my palm was a flesh cactus. I admit the rain didn't sound so pretty after that. I plucked the quills out one at a time, over a burrito of eggs, cheese, and black beans. The Rustins had natural gas, and the stove could be lit. It was a comfort to have a belly full of hot food. I ate in the master bedroom, right out of the cast-iron pan. After I was done, I got some packing blankets from the garage. I carried Dr. Rustin into the bedroom and stretched him out and covered him up. I set the picture of all of us together in his arms. I thanked him then for sharing his daughter and his home with me, and kissed him goodnight, and went to sleep myself. The rain stopped at about 2 in the morning. And when Gumby from across the street slipped into the master bedroom, I was already awake and listening for him. I didn't move while he stepped around the body on the floor, under the packing blankets, and crept to the side of the bed. He reached for a pillow and put a knee on the edge of the mattress. He was wired, quivering with tension, legs shaking, when he drew down the blanket and pressed the pillow over the face of the sleeper. His back was to me when I pushed aside the packing blankets and got up off the floor. But by the time I reached for the cast-iron frying pan, Gumby had realized that the person under the pillow wasn't struggling. He yanked the pillow back and gazed raptly and blankly into Dr. Rustin's calm, still face. Gumby had time to issue a little shriek and turn halfway around when I swung. I was jittery and amped up myself and hit him harder than I meant to. The pan connected with a resounding bong. He went boneless, limbs flying in 4 different directions, head whopped to the side. It felt like I'd struck a tree trunk. I smashed his glasses, his nose, and several teeth. He went down as if he were standing on the gallows and the hangman had opened the trap. I grabbed him by one foot and dragged him into the hall. I pulled him through the door at the end of the corridor into the two-car garage. It was three steps down, and his head struck every one. I didn't even wince for him. Dr. Rusted's big black Crown Vic sat in the nearest bay. I popped the trunk, scooped Gumby up, and dumped him in. I slammed the trunk on him. It took me about 10 minutes, hunting around by candlelight, to find Dr. Rusted's battery-powered hand drill. I squeezed the trigger and punched a dozen breathing holes in the trunk. If it didn't get too hot tomorrow, Gumby'd be all right till at least noon. You just can't sleep the same after belting an intruder with a frying pan, and by the time the sun came up, I was ready to go. I left through the garage, my backpack slung over one shoulder, loaded up with fresh bottles of water and a light picnic lunch. It would be dramatically satisfying to tell you I heard Gumby kicking and wailing to get out when I left, but there wasn't a sound coming from the trunk. He might have been dead. I can't swear he wasn't. The evening rain had scrubbed the sky bright and blue, and the day twinkled. So did the fresh downpour of nails in the road. Gumby's daughter was at the bottom of her driveway, staring at me with wide, frightened eyes. She was wearing the same black tracksuit with purple piping and the same silver bangle that had been around her wrist the day before. I wasn't going to speak to her. It seemed important to avoid acknowledging her for her safety as much as mine. But then she took a nervous step toward me and called out, "Have you seen my father?" she asked. I stopped in the road, nails crunching under my feet. "I did," I told her. "But he didn't see me. Bad luck for him." She withdrew a step, the fingers of one hand curling to her chest. I stalked a few more yards down the road, then couldn't help myself and went back. The girl stiffened. I could tell she wanted to run, but was stuck in place with fright, an artery beat in her slender throat. I grabbed the bangle around her wrist and yanked it off, a silver bracelet with crescent moon stamped on it. I hung it on my own arm. "That's not yours," I said. "I don't know how you can wear it."
He said," she gasped.
Her voice was small and her breath was rapid and shallow.
"He said he paid Yolanda $1,000 to babysit over the years, and her parents should have given it back, that they never should have let someone like Yolanda, like you, watch children."
Her face twisted in an ugly sort of way when she said that last bit.
"He said they owed us."
"Your father was owed something, and I gave it to him," I said. And I left her there. I went around the park this time. I didn't want to see a pile of dead penguins or smell them either. 17th Avenue borders the southern edge of City Park, and a squad from the National Guard had been deployed there to do some cleanup. A couple guys used a Humvee to drag wrecks out of the road. A few others plied push brooms across the blacktop to sweep aside the latest shimmering carpet of nails. But all of them worked in a despondent, desultory way. The way folks will when they know they've been assigned a pointless chore. It was like trying to bail out the Titanic with a teacup. Denver was sunk, and they knew it. The road crew were the lucky ones, though. Some of the other soldiers had been assigned the job of bagging corpses and lining them along the curb, same as Parks and Rec used to leave bagged trash for garbage collection. Just past where 17th crosses Fillmore, there's a handsome entrance to the park. A wall of glossy pink stone in a welcoming crescent that opens on an expanse of green as smooth as the surface of a billiard table. A couple of park benches, fashioned from steel wire, had been placed artfully to either side of the park entrance. An elderly couple had tried to squeeze in underneath one of those benches together for shelter from last night's drizzle, but it hadn't done them any good. The nails had gone right through the wire. A crow had found them and was in under the bench plucking at the old lady's face. A soldier in camo approached and bent down and yelled at the bird and clapped his hands. The crow jumped in fright and hopped up from under the bench with something in his mouth. From a few yards away, it looked like a quivering, soft-boiled egg. But as I approached, I could see it was an eyeball. The bird walked up the sidewalk with its fat, pearly prize, leaving bloody footprints behind. The soldier took three brisk steps to the curb and vomited in front of me. A hard cough followed by a wet spatter. a mess that smelled of bile and eggs. I came up short to keep from getting any of the spray on me. The soldier, a black guy, average height, downy little mustache, heaved again and coughed and spit. I offered him a bottle of water. He took it and swigged and spit once more. Drank again, long, slow swallows. "Thanks," he said. "Did you see where that bird went?" "Why?" "Because I think I'm going to shoot him for being a pig instead of a crow. His eyes are bigger than his stomach."
"You mean her eyes are bigger than his stomach."
"Huh," he said, and shivered weakly. "I'd like to shoot something. You can't imagine how badly I want to put a bullet somewhere it would do some good. I wish I was in with the real soldiers. There's a 50-50 chance we'll have boots on the ground in Georgia by sunup tomorrow. Shit about to go down."
"Georgia?" I asked. "They think Charlie Daniels might have had something to do with all this?"
He gave me a sad smile and said, "I thought something similar when I heard. Not that Georgia. This one is in that puddle of crap between Iraq and Russia, where everything is Al-Frigistan and El-Duchistan."
"Next to Russia, you said?"
He nodded. "I think Georgia used to be a part of it. The chemists who dreamed this shit up, clouds, rain, and nails, work for a company out there. A former U.S. company, if you can believe it. The Joint Chiefs want to strike with a dozen battalions. Biggest ground operation since D-Day."
"You said it's only a 50-50 chance?"
"The president has been on the phone with Russia to see if they'd be okay with him dropping a couple tactical warheads on the Caucasus. His stubby little fingers are itching to stab the button."
After all I'd seen in the last 48 hours, the idea of thumping our enemies with a few hundred megatons of hurt should have given me a rush of satisfaction, but it only made me antsy. I had the nervous, fidgety sensation that there was somewhere I needed to be, something I needed to be doing. It was the way a person feels when she's away from home and suddenly begins to worry she left a burner running on the stove. But I couldn't for the life of me identify what it was I needed to do to ease my anxiety.
"You want a bad guy to whoop? You don't have to fly halfway around the world. I can point you to one right here in Denver." He gave me a weary look and said, "I can't help you with looters. Maybe the Denver PD can take a complaint."
"How about a murderer?" I asked. "You got time to deal with one of them?"
Some of the exhaustion left his face and his posture improved just slightly.
"What murderer?"
"I walked down from Boulder yesterday to check in on my girlfriend's father, Dr. James Rusted. I found him dead in his front hallway. He took a tumble down the stairs and broke his neck." My soldier softened up a bit then, shoulders slumping.
"And you know it was murder? How?"
"Dr. Rusted was caught out in the rain like so many others, but he was able to get inside before he suffered anything worse than light injuries. He bandaged himself up and stretched out to rest and recover in his bedroom. I believe he was awakened by the sound of someone moving around in his daughter's bedroom upstairs. He was so surprised he didn't even bother to put on his glasses, but went straight up to see who was there. Perhaps he thought his daughter had returned home. But when he got up there, he found a looter. There was a confrontation. Only God and Dr. Rusted's assailant could tell you what happened next, but I believe that in the course of the struggle, Dr. Rusted toppled down the stairs and suffered the fatal injury." The soldier scratched the back of his head.
"You don't want to bring the National Guard into a crime scene. You want someone who knows about the art of detection."
"There's nothing to detect. The man who killed him is locked in the trunk of Dr. Rusted's Crown Victoria. He visited the house last night to kill me as well, but I was ready for him and slugged him with a frying pan. He won't suffocate. I drilled some holes in the lid of the trunk, but he might get awfully hot, so I recommend going right over there."
When I said that, the soldier's eyes about came out of his head.
"Why'd he try to kill you, too?"
He knew I had identified him as Dr. Rusted's murderer. "The guy in the trunk has a grudge against the entire Rusted family. Yolanda Rusted, the doctor's daughter, and my girlfriend, used to babysit this guy's daughter. After he found out Yolanda is gay, he was horrified and demanded that the doctor refund every cent of the babysitting money he'd paid over the years. The doctor rightly refused. Well, after the rain fell, this neighbor noticed that a car was missing from the garage, assumed the house was empty, and decided it would be a good time to do some stealing and settle the bill.
I'm sure he thought he was justified in looting Yolanda's jewelry box, but the doctor had a different point of view. While they were grappling, the intruder lost his watch. Later, when I asked this neighbor if he'd heard any ruckus in the doctor's house, I saw him looking at his bare wrist as if to check the time. You figured out he killed your girlfriend's daddy just because he glanced at his wrist? Well, it didn't help that his daughter was wearing one of Yolanda's bracelets. I recognized it straight away. I lifted my wrist to show him the silver bangle. I asked for it back this morning. Besides, if there was any doubt about what the neighbor did, it was cleared up when he entered the house at 2 a.m. to suffocate me with a pillow. He studied me for a moment longer, then turned his head and called to a couple of his compadres pushing brooms in the street. You guys want a break from cleanup? To do what? One of them asked. To grab a murdering bigot and drag his ass to the lockup. The two soldiers looked at each other. The one leaning on his broom said, Shit, why not? It'll give us something to do while we're waiting on the world to end. My soldier said, Come on, let's go. Jump in the Humvee. No, sir, I can't. I'm afraid you'll have to go back to Dr. Rusted's house without me. What do you mean you can't? We haul this guy into Denver PD, they're going to want you to give a statement. And I will, but they'll have to contact me at my house on Jackdaw Street. I left Dr. Rusted's daughter up in Boulder. I need to get back to her. Oh, he said, and looked away from me. Yeah. All right. I suppose she'll want to know about her old man. I didn't tell him the girl I wanted to get back to wasn't waiting on news of her father, on account of being just as dead as he was. I was glad to let my soldier think what he wanted as long as I could keep moving. As restless and antsy as I was, I couldn't bear the thought of returning to Dr. Rusted's and maybe losing another day in Denver. I told him where the police could find the doctor and his assailant and where they could locate me in Boulder when they wanted my statement. If they want a statement. If this even goes to a judge. My soldier took an uneasy look at the sky. If the rains keep falling, I think trial by jury might be a fond memory in a few months. We'll be back to frontier justice soon enough. Hanging people on the spot saves time and trouble. Eye for an eye, I asked. You know it, he told me, and turned to glare at the crow. I hope you're paying attention, you filthy beast. The crow, half a block away, squawked at us, then lifted its prize, opened its wings, and flapped laboriously away, getting while the getting was good. I was almost back to the pike when I came across Dillett's John Deere, crashed through a fence of slender wooden posts and dumped in a dusty lot, just shy of a bridge over the brown, noisy rush of the South Platte River. The windshield had been shattered into a dozen spiderweb fractures from the evening's rain. The driver's side door hung open on darkness. I climbed up on the running board for a peek inside. The interior was empty but scattered with bloody $100 bills. The handcuffs hung from the steel bar under the dash. Someone had left what at first looked like a filthy, uncooked sausage on the driver's seat. I leaned close, squinting at it, trying to figure out what it was, then realized it was a thumb and recoiled so fast I almost fell out onto the dirt. My stomach turned. Someone had clipped Teasdale's thumb off so he could slip the cuffs, and then his mystery accomplice had attempted to staunch the bleeding with money. There were some torn strips of bloody white silk on the floor and something glittering in the footwell of the passenger seat. I reached in and picked it out. A fake golden tiara. I don't know for sure that Teasdale met the Queen of the Apocalypse. I can't swear that she cut off part of his hand to enable his escape, or that she bandaged him with ribbons torn from her wedding dress, padded with money out of her carpet bag. I could not tell you if the two of them went to Canada together. Maybe they did, though. Maybe she taught him how to walk between raindrops. I left the John Deere behind and went on. I was no tractor thief and didn't have the confidence to try to drive a vehicle the size of a Tyrannosaurus Rex anyhow. But I did miss having a ride. I was 7 hours hoofing it through the hot, dry grass along the side of the Denver-Boulder Turnpike. I walked until I was footsore and weary and then walked some more. The state troopers and the prisoners from the Supermax weren't to be found on the 8 lanes of Pike that day. Maybe after yesterday's escape, it was decided that there was too much risk in trying to use them as a road crew. Or, and this struck me as more likely, maybe they didn't see the point. After last night's rainfall, the road was a trough filled with brassy spokes of sharpest crystal. All of yesterday's sweeping hadn't accomplished anything. I wasn't alone on the road. I saw lots of folks picking over abandoned cars, looking for loot. But this time no one bothered me. It was a quiet walk, no cars going by, no planes droning in the sky, no one to talk to. Almost no sound at all except the buzzing of flies. To this day, there are probably more flies feasting in the wrecks along those 18 miles of the pike than there are human beings in all of Colorado. As I was coming down the off-ramp in Boulder, I heard a boom that gave my heart a leap. People sometimes compare thunder to cannon fire. This was less like hearing a cannon go off and more like what you'd hear if you were shot from one. The sky was an expanse of filmy blue haze. At first it seemed there wasn't a cloud in it. Then I spied what was almost like the ghost of a cloud, a towering blue mound so big it would have made an aircraft carrier look like a kayak. Only it hardly seemed to be there at all. It was like a half-hearted sketch of a cloud, lightly penciled in over the peaks. The afternoon heat was mounting, though, and I thought we would get pounded again at the end of the day, harder than ever. It wasn't just that single blaring crash of thunder that made me think another storm was building. It was the almost airless quality to the late afternoon, a feeling like no matter how deeply I inhaled, my heart and lungs were never getting a full supply of oxygen. The crews from Staples and McDonald's were gone, and the football field was abandoned. A few earth movers had been scattered about, and the field itself had been blanketed with a layer of dry yellow sod, concealing the recent dead. Numbered white posts stood in ranks, all they had for grave markers. I'm sure there were enough dead in Boulder to plant the field thrice over, but the project seemed to have been discontinued. The whole town was hushed and still, almost no one out on the sidewalks. There was a terrible sense of the place steeling itself for the next and worst blow. That clamped-down air of silence went on for block after block, but there was nothing quiet about Jackdaw Street. Andropov had the radio and the TV going, top volume, just like when I left. You could hear it from the end of the street. That was interesting enough on its own. Power was out all over town, but he had his own source of juice, a Jenny or just a lot of batteries. That wasn't the only sound on the street. Elder Bent's house throbbed with carefree song. They were singing what at first sounded like a religious hymn, but after a more careful listen turned out to be Peter Cetera's Glory of Love. What a strange thing, to hear voices lifted in joy after a long, hot day of walking with nothing to listen to except the idiot harmonic of the flies. As I closed in on my house, I saw Templeton watching from the open bay door of his garage. He had come right up to the edge of the shadows, but, as always, had held up there, knowing how sick the sunlight would make him. He had his cape over his shoulders, and when he saw me coming, he spread his arms out to either side and showed me his fangs. I made a cross with my fingers, and he obediently retreated into the gloom. I stood in the street looking at Ursula's house, thinking how nice it would be to go in there and sit on the couch and rest my feet. Maybe she would bring me some sun tea. Later, when the evening was cool, I could stretch out with Yolanda and slip the silver bracelet off my wrist and onto hers. Then I considered the boarded-up windows of Andropov's apartment, shaking from the noise behind them. I thought about the fat, surly Russian calling next door to tell Elder Bent that old Unisuk was going to make trouble for him with the FBI. I thought about the way the former chemist had come in burning rubber right before the first thunderstorm hit, the way he grabbed Martina by the arm and manhandled her into the house while she protested. Then there was what I'd seen in his bathroom when I peered through the window around the side of the house. Plastic tubing, glass beakers, a gallon jug of some clear chemical solution. I wondered what part of Russia he was from, if he had emigrated from anywhere near Georgia. There was another boom of thunder, loud enough to make the air quiver. If I thought it over long enough, I could probably devise a sly way to lure him out of his first-floor apartment so I could slip in while he wasn't around and have another look in his bathroom. Then again, if I waited another night and he knew I was around, he might come for me himself. I decided subterfuge was overrated and that it was better, as Admiral Lord Nelson supposedly said, to go right at him. I sank to one knee, took the water bottles out of my knapsack and lined them up on the curb. Then I began to collect fistfuls of crystal spikes. I piled them in until the bag was two-thirds full and as heavy as a sack of marbles. I zipped it shut, hefted it once to get the feel of it, and went up the steps to Andropov's porch. I booted the door once, twice, a third time, hard enough to jolt it in the frame. I roared, "Immigration, Ivan! Open up! Donald Trump says we gotta drag your ass back to Siberia! Either you let us in or we'll kick the door off its hinges!" I stepped to the side and pressed myself against the wall. The door flew open, and Andropov stuck his fat, sagging face out. "I emigrate my cock to your hole, you lesbian bitch," he started, but he didn't get any further than that. I brought the sack down on the top of his head with both hands, and he collapsed to one knee, which is where I wanted him. I brought my own knee up into the center of his face and connected with the bony crunch of a snapping nose. He groaned and dropped to all fours. He had a big, rusty wrench in one hand that I didn't intend to give him a chance to use. I brought the heel of one cowboy boot down on his knuckles and heard bones split. He screamed and let go. I scooped up the wrench and stepped over him into the front hall. It was dark and bare and had a sour smell of mildew and body odor. The green flower print wallpaper was peeling away to show the water-stained plaster beneath. A left turn took me to a squalid living room. The couch and end tables were the kind of stuff most folks put out on the sidewalk, next to a cardboard sign that says "Free." There was a bong made out of a 2-liter Coke Zero bottle, 5 inches of brown slop that looked like diarrhea water in it. He had an iPod jacked into a Mophie power station next to a big Bluetooth speaker. Twitchy synth loops played over a steady wop-wop beat. I jerked the power cable out of his sound deck, and that killed his St. Petersburg electronica. But the apartment was still filled with bellowing noise. Somewhere in the rear of the apartment, Hugh Grant was shouting over a background soundtrack of swelling violins. Beneath that came a stream of angry, muffled cries. I stumbled in the short, dim hall between the living room and the bedroom. An enormous hot pink vibrator in the shape of a horse's phallus rolled under my foot. I lurched and put a hand out against a door to my right, and it swung open to show the dingy little bathroom I'd glimpsed before. He had arranged a lab for himself in there. I wasn't any chemist, but it for sure looked like he had a sink full of crystal, glassy yellowish-white shards. Several big brown jugs labeled as brake fluid. Brake fluid? Sat in the bathtub. Rubber tubing ran between flasks of amber liquid. The whole place had the sharp stink of nail polish. The muffled cries were closer now. I backed out of the bathroom and went on to the bedroom. Martina was on the big brass bed, handcuffs on her wrists, hands behind her back. A black leather bracelet had been buckled around her right ankle. One end of an extension cable was clipped to it. The other end had been elaborately knotted around one of the shiny brass bedposts. The bedsheets were a tangle under her bony, light frame. She peered out from beneath the twisted Debbie Harry coils of her golden hair like a bright-eyed fox peering out from a heap of briars. Andropov had strapped a piece of duct tape across her mouth. A laptop was open on a nearby dresser, playing what looked like Notting Hill at top volume. She glared at me and kicked the wall with her free foot, same as she'd been doing the day before, the only way she could let anyone know she needed help. She struggled to rise to her knees, writhing from side to side and lifting the sharp edges of her hip bones into the air. It just about looked like porno. A 22-year-old alabaster-skinned stripper in cheap white underwear and a tight little Ramones T-shirt that was so threadbare and thin it barely looked fit for use as a dish rag. What made me hold up, though, wasn't my surprise to find her a prisoner in Andropov's bedroom. It was the sight of a glass pipe on the end table, with more yellowish chunks of crystal in it. crystal that was looking less and less like lethal rain and more like you-know-what. I was taking it all in, waiting for my brain to catch up to my eyes when the mad Russian crashed in. He stumbled past me. It was dark and the floor was carpeted in sour-smelling unwashed laundry, then turned and stood between me and her. The lower half of his face was sticky with blood, and his broken left hand twitched against his chest. Tears crawled down his bristly cheeks.
"You stay away from her, lesbian! She not go away with you!"
The way he called me a lesbian, like it was the dirtiest word he knew, got the better of me. I slapped him with an open hand. I didn't have any words, just an overwhelming desire to smack his fat, foolish, tragic face. The instant I did it, he erupted into sobs that shook his whole body. I moved around him and snatched the duct tape off Martina's mouth. If I repeated all the four-letter words that came pouring out of her, your ears would catch on fire. When she finally started to make sense, what she said was,
"I tried to leave, and crazy asshole locked me here 2 days now. Crazy fucking piece of turd!"
And she stretched toward him, getting as close as she could, and spit on his head.
"2 days he run Notting Hill over and over, only unlock me to piss. He smoked too much his own shitty drugs."
Andropov turned to face her, holding his head in his hands and sobbing wretchedly.
"You said you run away with this lesbian. You said you have me arrest and live with girls who have the pussy to eat. Leave me for women at end of world. I said it and I meant it. You go to jail 1,000,000 years.
He looked at me with pleading, miserable, lunatic eyes.
"Every day, all the time, she parades herself almost naked to you lesbians. Always she is calling to tell me she planned to sleep with you both. She say only women make her come, and she laugh at me. Yes, I laugh at you. I laugh at your penis, always soft."
And then they were screaming at each other in Russian, and she was spitting at him again, and my head was about to split from the way the both of them were carrying on. He drew back one arm like he was going to backhand her, and I thumped him in the stomach with the wrench. Not hard, but hard enough to drive the air out of him and bend him double. He swayed, sank to his knees, and curled up on his side, crying his guts out. You never saw a more pitiful sight. I stepped around Andropov and paused Notting Hill. I spotted a chrome key by the laptop and figured I'd try it on the handcuffs. I sat on the edge of the bed with Martina, and her bracelets popped off with a snick. She rubbed her bruised wrists.
"Filthy, horrible, soft-dicked man," she said.
But her voice was lower now, and she was shaking. I picked up the glass pipe with the crystals in it. "What's this?"
"Drug he make me take to shut me up," she said. "I tried to leave him before, and he hit me, choke me. He use what he sell. It's like a mad killer. He punch me because he can't fuck me anymore."
Throwing this last at him. "What kind of drug?"
"Crystal meth."
She bit her lower lip and began to wrestle with the buckle around her ankle. "Okay," I said. "Tell me something else. He isn't from the area around Georgia, is he?" Her brow furrowed.
"What? No. Moscow."
"And I guess he doesn't know how to make the kind of crystals that are falling from the sky."
"What do you mean? No, no," she barked,
a harsh, ugly laugh.
"He is washed-up pharmacist, not genius." "I love you," he said to her from where he was curled up on the floor. "If you leave, I shoot myself."
By now she had freed her ankle from the strap around it. She leapt up and began to kick him.
"Good! I hope so! I buy you the bullets myself!"
He did not attempt to escape from his place on the floor. Her foot found his ass again and again. I'd heard about all I could stand. I dropped the wrench on the bed and left the two of them to the pleasure of each other's company. I stood on the porch, leaning against the railing, inhaling the clean, clear air with its taste of the mountains and summer. A few members of the comic cult had heard the commotion and come out onto the porch, Elder Bent among them, his stepdaughters flanking him. The girls were pretty brunettes in their early 20s, and each of them wore matching ceremonial hubcaps on their heads. It was only the best for Elder Bent's pretties. Golden 59 Lancer hubcaps that looked like UFOs from a black-and-white movie. Martina emerged in a pair of jeans so tight I'm surprised she could get into them without lubricant. She stood beside me, pushed her crazed hair back from her face. "You'll do me a favor?"